Hello and welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. I'm Alex Newman, stepping in this week for John Heumann, who is busy working on his dissertation. Today I'm joined by news editor Emma Powell. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
Media tech and pharma writer Megan Boxall.
Hi, Alex.
Hello. And Algy Tips Hall, who is in the studio as ever on the ones and twos with Dom Toms.
Hello and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to talk about stocks which should be resilient to the risk of a hard Brexit in this episode. And we'll also be getting an update on our tips of the year. But Megan, I wanted to first start with you, if I may. So there was a big story this week where the European Commission slapped Google with a 2.4 billion euro fine. Why was that?
Google has, according to the European Commission, been illegally, it's given itself an illegal advantage by using its own search engine to promote its shopping channel, which is pretty much a price comparison website. So when you go on Google and you type in, I don't know, teddy bear, the first thing that comes up, the first hit on Google is its own shopping channel. And the shopping channel, like other price comparison websites, work by receiving revenue from the retailers. So they pay every time Google's shopping channel manages to get a sale, in the same way that other price comparison websites work. But that becomes an advantage when the search engine being used is owned by the same company, and 95% of Europeans use Google as their search engine of choice. So yeah, a big advantage which the European Commission has decided enough is enough. And it is a big story because, firstly, it's the biggest fine that the European Commission's ever handed down to a tech company, especially a US tech company, where there's been talk of it being political tension and whether or not this is going to fray ties between the UK and the EU and the US and all of that. But on top of that, the US tech has been so dominant for such a long time. And this is the first real move to sort of stop that dominance of the Googles, of the Amazons, of Facebook.
Or to rein in their activities, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's very interesting. And Google actually has two more investigations that the European Commission's looking into on Google at the moment. One's to do with its Android and one's to do with its advertising platform.
Right.
Which are both, again, major things that having a search engine and being so dominant in the space is a massive advantage for them.
So there's another part of this fine as well. If within 90 days Google doesn't remove its teddy bear shop from the top of the search engine, there's going to be a pretty hefty ongoing penalty.
Yeah, so from that, 5% of daily revenue. And
so that's that's 5% of its average daily worldwide revenues.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So yeah, and for Google, which makes so much money, it's a massive fine. While the current fine, I mean, it's a drop in the ocean compared to what Google makes annually, $90 billion last year. It's the wider repercussions, and not just the financial repercussions. The fact that Google has spent a long time creating this image as a good boy of tech.
Right.
It's there to help. But actually, if it is being so, using its position in what the European Commission has called illegally, that's not great for its image.
Okay. And what's the broader read across for UK companies? You flagged a couple of companies in the piece which might be impacted by this.
So the direct impact is definitely the price comparison websites, which have said that they've been struggling due to the fact that, especially when people are using mobile phones more, it's pretty much the only hit you get on your screen, the Google shopping channel, the Google ads, they come first. So paying Google is only the only way in the age of using your mobile phone to get your company at the top of the Google search chain. So now that Google's having to maybe rein that in, that's going to be possibly good news for the price comparison websites, because they'll be on a level pegging with Google shopping,
Google's own brand shops.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the likes of MoneySupermarket.com or GoCompare. So did their shares react?
Their shares
haven't
reacted at all. And I don't know whether that's because it's too much of a tenuous link. I mean, it's not that widely publicised yet that they have been struggling. And they've been driving revenues up so much in the last few years. It's not actually clear that there's been too much of a slowdown.
Okay.
It's very easy to relate price comparison websites slow down to other things. This is just one factor. So whether or not it's going to be have a long-term benefit for these companies, we don't know yet, which is maybe why the response has been quite muted at the moment.
Okay, and just continuing with the impact of the FAMGS, that's a horrible acronym, isn't it? The Facebook.
I heard GAFA the other day, which is better.
That's better, yeah, GAFA. But you need the M as well in there, don't you?
Yeah, GAFAM.
So anyway, we're talking about Facebook Amazon, Apple, Microsoft and Google's and their impact on UK PLC. Another story this week, Imagination Technologies has put itself up for sale. So what's the latest?
Yeah, so Imagination Technologies had a pretty terrible year. So the background to this is that throughout its history, it's provided a chip that goes in the iPhone. And all iPhones up until this point have used this Imagination Technologies chip. But a few months ago, Apple decided that it had been able to create its own chip and it wouldn't be relying on Imagination Technologies anymore. So that's terrible news for Imagination Technologies, which they've never actually said exactly how much revenue comes from Apple, but it's estimated to be about 50% and even more of its profits. And analysts have said that without sales from Apple, Imagination will move into a net debt position, into a net loss position, and it's already got debt, which it's paying hefty interest on. Mm. So, I mean, it's all not looking good. So
it's pretty terminal for Imagination Technologies if they don't find a buyer.
Exactly. So that's why they are now saying... So first of all, they said they were going to put their two less well-known divisions, which aren't... It's the non-chip making part of the division of the company up for sale to try and wipe their debt. But I don't know whether or not it's because they haven't had enough interest in those two divisions or if the interest they have had, they've said, well, we only want you as a whole. We don't want just these two less well-known divisions.
Okay.
So, yeah, they've now made the decision to put themselves up for sale. And the share price responded pretty well. And they're clearly a very good tech company. I mean, the fact that the most popular phone of all time has used their chips for the last 10 years means that they're doing something good. Mm. So it could be that they're a target for a Samsung or even Google because they do virtual reality stuff as well. Or even Apple, although I don't know if that would be
This struck me as pretty odd that that Apple may have caused this crisis for the company and may yet save it. I mean, who's speculating that they would buy the company now?
I've heard people saying, and there's been a few sort of market watchers saying, I mean, if Apple were to make an offer now, they've done very well for themselves.
Right.
And actually, if Apple haven't managed to create their own chips, then they're going to have to buy Imagination.
Okay.
But I actually don't know whether or not there is some sort of law that states that you can't have such an impact on a group's share price like this. And Amazon's got into trouble for doing it before, for destroying a company, another retailer's share price, and then buying it.
Right.
But this was just crazy. I mean, it lost about two-thirds of its value in one day.
Mm. So we'll see if it recovers, if there is an acquirer out there. And there may be a buyer for another company this week. Emma, I just wanted to turn to Hornby in the news section there. They're set for a takeover. It may not be much of a happy ending, though, for the company.
Well, yeah, Hornby, which for such a small company gets so much coverage, but it's because it's had such a rough time of it recently. But this is actually a mandatory offer that they've received. And it's because Phoenix UK, which was previously, it was also a majority shareholder, but they basically took up or bought the 20% stake of New Pistoa, which actually, funnily enough, was the institution that tried to oust the chairman of Hornby, who was also a director, actually, of UK Phoenix. I know some people were saying New Pistoa has kind of succeeded in getting rid of the chairman because Roger Bannum has actually agreed to step down after they acquired this extra 20%. So they've now got this 55% of Hornby. So they've been forced to make an offer. And so, yeah, so they've obviously got this mandatory offer now. There's no premium, so it's just 32p a share is what it works out at. It was actually what the shares were trading at the day prior to this bid being made. I mean, we had Hornby on a sell all along. They've had so many profit warnings. They almost breached their banking covenants once, but they were kind of given a bit more room to kind of get themselves in order by Barclays. I mean, the upshot is that obviously there's one majority shareholder now that owns 55% rather than two. I guess it's just how illiquid the shares become, really, because it's going to be, you know, somewhere between 0% and 45% that's going to be the free float. So, I mean, we've said sell all along.
What's really interesting, I think, about the whole Hornby thing is, as you said, we all know about it, we all talk about it, and it's because it's a big, iconic name, but no one's able to create any extra value from the brand, it seems.
Right.
And they're lumbered with lots of manufacturing, which is something that Bearball also talks about in this magazine. So, I mean, we've got these two great articles kind of crossing over. And it's a very interesting case study. And, you know, when brand value perhaps isn't what, as investors, we always interpret it to be, which is, you know, a license to print money, essentially.
So do we expect 3 years in under private equity ownership now and then a rebrand and a relaunch and a heavily indebted reflotation?
You think as an investment, the story is going to keep on coming around, don't you? Because everyone knows about Hornby and Scare Electric, and everyone thinks you should be able to create real value from that brand. It's just it hasn't happened.
Right.
And I mean, if it can't happen, if you can't grow a company like this, then private ownership's probably a logical, you know, way to go. But I mean, I don't know if Phoenix is what Phoenix is thinking, but obviously they're going to have a massive stake now.
It's actually worth noting, sorry, Phoenix have said we intend or we plan to retain Hornby's AIM listing. So they want to keep it as a private company, hence the kind of question over liquidity, I guess, that this isn't one that they're looking to kind of reach 75%, you know, and you know, get the acceptances and then take it private. They've actually said they would like to retain the AIM listing.
Good stuff. Well, undoubtedly, we'll give oversized coverage to Hornby in the future as well. Let's turn to this week's cover feature, which is by companies editor Ian Smith. And he looked at companies which we think could be insulated from a hard Brexit. So in the introduction, he writes, "Beyond the polarised discussion of hard and soft exit, it is near impossible for private investors to predict what deal, if any, will come out of the negotiating window." And with that in mind, he's selected a list of stocks, most of which are IC buy tips already, really, which should do well regardless. And he's broken these down into a couple of categories, but they're primarily dollar earners, which, of course, is anyone who follows the FTSE 100's gyrations in response to political news at the moment tends to do quite well because they tend to go up whenever the pound falls. So these also have little or no UK or EU revenue, and many of which report in dollars. So one of the companies Ian talks about, Emma, is Standard Chartered. It's not a buy tip, but he singled it out for its long-term growth and focus on Asia. You know, it's a dollar earner, and it's not too heavily exposed to UK and EU. I mean, why would this be well insulated as a sort of Brexit hedge stock?
Yeah, well, like you said, it does in a similar way, actually, to HSBC. It's a dollar earner. Its real growth prospects are in Asia. It's the whole kind of rise of the middle class in Asia. Provision of private provision of pensions, wealth management, all growing areas, obviously in a rapidly growing population that is kind of increasing its earnings on average. So it's got that aspect of it. It's also trading at around 0.8 times. So actually, if you look at, that's 0.8 times forecast tangible net assets, which is one of the cheapest banks, actually.
So what's an average then for the sector? Would you expect to be
an average?
Sort of just over one,
so HSBC is about 1.1.
Right.
RBS is about, it's 0.8, 0.9. You've got Barclays, which is the cheapest at the moment, but there's obviously various reasons for that, given the news flow, at about 0.7. Lloyd's is about 1.4, so that's very expensive, but it's towards the lower end. And funnily enough, obviously, it's kind of the fact that it is insulated and people see it as a stock that's insulated was demonstrated by the fact that when the referendum result was announced last year, HSBC and Standard Chartered kind of carried on going up. And obviously the Lloyds, the Barclays and the RBS, which have very large UK retail banking operations, just took a nosedive. I mean, obviously they've recovered slightly, but they're very exposed to the whole Brexit and everything that happens around there. Whereas the real growth prospects for Standard Chartered is it's Asia.
Right. But I mean, this is still a bank in something of a recovery mode, isn't it? I mean, that partly explains the you know, the price to net assets.
Oh yeah, I mean it definitely is, hence why we've got it on a hold, and it's currently not paying out a dividend at the moment until kind of the return on equity recovers. But again, I would argue that that's kind of it's in the price, that kind of risk. It has been making some good progress though under Bill Winters as part of its whole recovery plan in terms of lowering its loan losses. So, you know, when loans go bad, because obviously it was exposed to commodities and companies in that sector. So yeah, it is doing a good job, I would say, overall in terms of its recovery, in terms of reducing its risk-rated assets. But, you know, it's not... It does have risk in there, hence why we don't have it on a buy.
Sure, but the risks, I suppose, are on a parallel track to the risk to the UK economy.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you could argue with HSBC and Standard Chartered, the risk is very much linked to emerging markets, right, okay. And that's just another risk. But if you're talking about Brexit, then that's something different.
Good stuff. And Megan, another of Ian's picks is Craneware, which I suppose, you know, compared to Standard Chartered, is quite an expensive stock, but it's got a few links to, you know, any potential fallout in the UK. Why is that, and why? What tell us about the company and why it's you know, completely de-risked from anything Brexit related.
Yeah, so Craneware is pretty much a US company, to be honest. It is actually based in Scotland, but and its management's all Scottish, but all of their operations are in the US. They run software which helps make US hospitals and general healthcare provision more efficient, and that is a massive topic because. Right. I mean, most people know that if anyone followed the US presidential election would know that US healthcare is not very efficient, and it's been a massive political topic over there. And everyone knows that something has to be done about taking some costs. US healthcare is so expensive. And Craneware is trying to do that and doing it really, really well. It's signing up more and more hospitals, more and more sort of state-run services. It's bringing in its software, which helps pass patients through the healthcare system quicker. That's their aim. So everything that they're doing is in the US. Mm. And yeah, so for that reason, they're not really being touched by what's happening in the UK or the EU at the moment at all. So they are in a really good position. Like you say, they're a little bit more expensive. A lot of that has come from a sort of post-Brexit vote boost, which their share price saw in the wake of the referendum. But still, there's a lot of value to be found there because there's such growth potential. Mm. And also, I mean, they're a massive takeover target for any hospital healthcare provider in the US, of which there are so many companies, because they do so well. So yeah, a great company, which is definitely one for the Brexit proof portfolio.
Right, and another healthcare pick that Ian's it made here is NMC Healthcare. So that's another potentially high growth stock. It's focused on the Middle East, slightly cheaper than Craneware. I mean, for investors who might be a bit unfamiliar with NMC Healthcare.
Yeah, I mean,
can you give us a sense of what it's all about?
It's an interesting company, NMC. It's a hospital provider, but it's based in the Middle East.
Yeah.
It literally just is a private hospital. It builds hospitals, runs hospitals, and they're amazing, these hospitals. The pictures of them, they're like 5-star hotels. And they're just growing really, really quickly because there is this massively, hugely growing healthcare market in the Middle East, because it's one of the things that Middle Eastern politics wants to get right, because it's a sign of wealth, a good healthcare service. And Abu Dhabi and Dubai, they're all trying to boost their healthcare services. And NMC's placed itself really well for that. It's just buys land, it builds a hospital, it fills it with beds.
And these are growing populations as well. So you've got you've got a growing market for the services.
And aging populations. So again, they're just not based in the UK at all. Their listing here, it's a sensible listing because there is a market here. There are a few Middle Eastern hospital providers which have London listings. But apart from that, there's very little ties. I mean, it's run by people who live in that country. They're based in Abu Dhabi.
Again, nothing to do with Brexit.
No. And right. I mean, you could say that about when Ian and I were talking about this. There are so many healthcare and pharmaceutical companies.
What about Al-Noor? Isn't that another one in there?
Yeah, a bit more risky though. Well, it's not actually, doesn't even exist anymore. It's now owned by Mediclinic. Yeah, it was bought by Mediclinic. But yeah, that is another one. But they have, most of their revenue comes from Switzerland, so there's still a little bit of European tie there.
Yeah,
not existent in NMC. And also, so Ian's pointed out AstraZeneca and Shire in his article as well, because most of their revenue comes from dollars, pharmaceuticals. The US is the big market for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, in the companies Ian picks out in the piece, I mean, pharma pretty well represented here. So we've got Hikma as well and GSK. And he's looked at the whole of the FTSE 350. and broken it down by non-UK or EU revenue split, which is, I think, quite interesting way to approach this subject. So that's all in the feature in this week's mag. Another feature we've got, penned by our tips editor who's in the studio with us today's Algie Halls. Look at the tips of the year.
Yes, yeah, maybe it's worth mentioning my feature comes after another one allied to Ian's, which is Where Next for the Pound, which
right.
is obviously key to the stocks he's presenting. But
and the stocks we've picked for tips of the year.
Well, slightly, but I mean, it's interesting you should say that, because it was at the end when I after we'd picked them all, I put in my initial write up that I felt we probably were. Had overdone it unwittingly on dollar exposure,
right?
So that's a big worry for me personally. I don't know where, you know, what are going to happen with currencies, but I think given what's happened with the pound, and also, you know, yesterday we had Mark Carney making you know, somewhat hawkish comments, and the pound jumped by you know, by 1% against the dollar, which is a, you know, a big move. So obviously, you know, where we are, there's a great deal of uncertainty with currency, and you know, and it could go either way, as the other feature in the magazine explains.
Right.
But anyway, yeah. So dollar exposure was a bit of a worry, but the dollar hasn't really done much against sterling so far this year. It's good. I mean, it's fallen a bit against sterling overall. But probably the oil price has been the biggest influence.
Mm.
And I mean, when we picked the tips, there were because we hadn't gone for resources stocks last year, which you could say, you know, the reasons we hadn't gone for resources stocks were clear when they tanked at the beginning of the year, but they recovered sharply afterwards. We kind of thought we should have some resources exposure in here, and we went for some stocks which just should benefit from the stability
right.
in the slightly higher price, and they really have this, you know, or one of them in particular, RPS, that story's playing out for it. But we've also got Cairn Energy, which Alex yep. was your tip.
I'll hold my hands up here. It's the laggard of the group.
But also the oil price probably isn't that different now than it was at the beginning of the year. But the issue was that people pricing the momentum
sure.
in these things, and there's obviously quite a lot of hope that the momentum would continue with what was going on with OPEC, etc. That hasn't transpired. But, you know, Cairn hasn't actually really done anything wrong, has it?
No. It's got a number of factors at play, Cairn. I mean, they've got arbitration proceedings in India, got tax disputes. Their drilling's going fairly well. I mean, they've got this offshore Senegal program.
Mm-hmm.
That's been going
that.
Pretty well. I mean, they've got a lot of cash on their balance sheet. That was one of the reasons we opted for them, as opposed to other mid-tier oilers in the sector, which might have some debt issues. Nothing's changed too much, but certainly the sentiment, which, you know, is obviously a key driver of share prices, has gone quite bearish since the beginning of the year, which probably explains why they're slightly underwater.
And also, I mean, one of the things, when you pitch this idea to me and the rest of the team, one of the things I really liked about it is that there's always something really good about companies which are investing in during the bottom of the cycle,
yeah.
because that's when you can create real value by, you know, in their case, renting out rigs and drills on the cheap and just keep you on going. And then, when the market does pick up, you've got more product to sell.
Yeah.
So they're doing that. I mean, fundamentally, and I found this with this review, and the tips of the year they've done poorly so far this year. They've delivered a total return on aggregate of 2.8%.
So they're up as a group. We can still claim that headline, but it's below the FTSE All Share.
Below the FTSE All Share, which is up 6.4%. And then also what I've done as well is just looked at an unweighted view of the index. So all the constituents unweighted to market cap, and that's up 9.5%, or 7.5% is the median average.
Can you explain what that means?
And what the median average?
No, in terms of weighting them by.
Oh,
six.
Wait, sorry. So obviously the index is weighted. So what you see when you look at an index is predominantly how the largest companies, how the shares in the largest companies have performed, which is fair enough if you're thinking about the way institutions invest or what you may be able to buy in an ETF. But most private investors don't pay any attention to weightings when they construct a portfolio. And our tips of the year don't either. But Cairn was the big loser, as we've touched on, which is down 28%. Ouch. But it's doing nothing wrong. So it's really, a lot of it's coming down to oil and possibly a bit of disappointment with the slowness of that Indian arbitration. Correct me if you think differently, Alex.
Well, I mean, arbitration tends to take a while, doesn't it?
It does. Beginning of next year, we should know, apparently.
I think we shouldn't beat ourselves up too much. I mean, obviously, we're focused on one of the laggards there. But, I mean, you point to a couple which are near the top of the pile. So Merck, we've had some quite good news.
Yeah, so RPS is the best performer, up 23%. And then Merck, in my write-up, I've said there's some companies that we've tipped where I feel they haven't been rewarded for the good news. And although Merck is up 8.4% in this table, at the time I was writing it, there was a lot of negative sentiment because of all the debate over drug pricing in the US. But we've had a lot of change in that just over the last few days, and that's put another few percentages on Merck. But, I mean, Megan can maybe tell us about what's going on with that one.
Yeah, Megan, I mean, doesn't matter so much if the drug trial results are as good as they have been.
Yeah, well, yeah, like Algie says, they have had some very good good trial results, and they're leading the way in terms of global cancer care and novel drugs. They have sort of, when we tipped them, there was a two-way battle going on between Merck and Bristol Myers Squibb, and 6 months on, Merck is far and away in the lead. Bristol Myers Squibb's had some poor results in that time, and Merck's just been like, it's almost every few weeks they come out with another, and it's often on the same drug as well. It's a drug called Keytruda, which Algie talks about in the article, and it is that every time they put it out for a trial, it succeeds. And it was actually it became the first cancer drug ever to be approved for just cancer, or rather than like lung cancer,
right?
Or normally drugs would be approved per body part, but not Keytruda's just claimed it all, which it is really good. But like Algie says, it kind of has been overshadowed by the ongoing debate about US drugs pricing, because Keytruda is really expensive because it is this incredibly novel immuno-oncology drug, and because of that and the ongoing debate about whether US drugs are too expensive, it means that maybe it hasn't received the praise it should have done, because not many people can afford it.
Didn't have some pretty good news today.
Yeah, so again, this was not in cancer care. This was a sort of a novel statin. It's not a statin, but it's a cholesterol busting drug. It's called a c-met inhibitor, and what Merck has managed to do, which no other pharmaceutical company has managed to do, is get one of these through a clinical trial with positive results. So it's been a really long trial. It's been about 3 years, but over that time this drug lowered the chance of patients with high cholesterol having a coronary event such as a heart attack or a stroke. So other companies have tried and failed to get a type of this drug through clinical trials. Merck's done it, but what was weird about it was management weren't overly enthusiastic. And really, if the trial was as good as the headline numbers say it was, I mean, it should be incredible for Merck, because statins make so much money. They're the best-selling drugs of all time because so many people in the world have high cholesterol. So the fact that Merck's management weren't overly enthusiastic does mean that maybe they're not sure the FDA, even on these good trial results, is going to give the drug the green light. But that isn't something that we've sort of, that failure had kind of already been priced into Merck, because no one expected it to do well.
It's good to underpromise as well, I suppose.
Well, yeah, and also I think we should say about Merck as well, when we tipped it, Megan's idea was partly based around, my goodness, you can get an amazing US pharma company here really cheaply because of this fear about drug pricing. So what we said about drug pricing, I mean, we anticipated that it would carry on as an issue, but now it does seem to be coming off, which is
yeah. Was at the time, wasn't it? It was a little bit more expensive than other US pharma companies, but the sector in general was just so low at the time.
A good time to get a US pharma giant.
Another feature of the tips of the year, I mean, they were all fairly decent yielders. you picked out this year, Algie. I mean, and one at the top of the poll there nearly is Aviva, which seems to have a bit of a virtuous cycle at the moment. So, I mean, that's been doing well, hasn't it, Emma?
Yeah, it's up so far on the tip of the year. It's our income tip of the year. In some ways, it's kind of following similar trends to other life assurers, but it's a lot more immature in its kind of movement or shift towards those trends. It's on about 10 times the next 12 months forecast earnings, but it's kind of growing its asset management business, obviously following its merger with Friends Life. That gave it a lot more assets under management, but also it's growing its multi-asset product, which is called AIMS. It's kind of a challenger to GARS, but also they're doing things in terms of trying to diversify more and expand into China and Asia, given the market's very immature there. So yeah, it's kind of again, those are trends across the industry, but Aviva is, you know, things like Standard Life, which has obviously gone through a quite a transformational merger in itself, but they were very, you know, mature in terms of moving towards asset management. Aviva's now really making the effort to do that, really only in the past 12 months, which I think is why obviously it was more cheaply rated. But now we're starting to see the kind of the positive results from this kind of diversification throughout the whole business, you know, in its last reported results even. So that's, I think, why the shares are re-rating so much, and a kind of we've seen really good returns actually. And like you said, actually, it is a good yielder. You know, you get a yield of north of 4%. So
Good stuff. Algie, thoughts on Aviva?
Yeah, no, Aviva's doing what it should, what Emma thought it would do. So that's very satisfying. I think Greencore actually probably is the, if I was going to pick out a tip which has been making good progress and hasn't been rewarded for it, it's that one, because that was tipped on the back by Bradley Gerrard, who isn't actually with us anymore.
He's
dead to us. He's left the IC. But it bought this American company called Peacock, and it's been doing very well with that acquisition. But it's biggest customer in the US, and one of its weaknesses is it does have very large customers, and its biggest US customer, a meat processing company called Tyson, bought this rival, and the market sold off the Greencore shares massively. And I personally kind of think the sentiment's still off quite a lot on Greencore. But in actual fact, the length of contracts between Tyson and Peacock mean that it won't be a problem for quite a long time if there's going to be one. But also they've co-invested in manufacturing, which suggests that actually the relationship's far closer than the market's perceived it to be. And there's also been talk about deepening the relationship. So this acquisition that Tyson has made could actually mean Greencore, its subsidiary in the US, Peacock, starts winning more work from Tyson rather than losing work. And the other thing about the Tyson acquisition is that the multiple that it's been done on, which is a kind of 15 times enterprise value to cash profit multiple, which is just a valuation term. But anyway, that suggests the entire Greencore business is really significantly undervalued. Right. Or it definitely would be in the if someone was to come along and bid for it. So, right. I mean, I just think it's one of those cases where everything's going well at the moment. A lot of dollar exposure, actually, with this one. Everything's going well at the moment, but the market's kind of seen a risk which may actually transpire not to be there at all, and it could be quite the opposite. It could be what's actually happened could actually be a very good thing for Greencore.
Interesting. So, and 6% up so far. 5.9% up. You think it's got a lot more to run this year then?
Yeah, I think it's that there's a lot going for it. I think growth is going to come through, and I think people may start looking at the rating. You know, as long as the market holds up, people start looking at that rating and thinking, hang on, that it's actually really quite good value.
Excellent. Okay, thanks to that, Algie. And Megan, Emma, thanks to you too. This week's magazine is called Brexit Proof Shares. There's loads of content in there. We've got a look at Japan, that feature that Algie mentioned as well, where next for the pound, all the usual personal finance and company results write-ups. Brexit-proof shares. It's in shops from Friday, £4.90. And we'll speak to you next week. Thank you.
Hey, Denver, tired of battling the mighty pollen? We've got your back. Aspire Allergy and Sinus offers lasting allergy relief so you can chuck those temporary fixes and savor that sweet, sweet taste of victory over pollen. With same-day results and tailor-made treatment plans, we've turned the tables on allergies. Aspire patients enjoy relief that lasts for years. Schedule your appointment today at aspireallergy.com. Turn your daily sneeze-a-thon into a breeze with Aspire Allergy and Sinus. Go to aspireallergy.com.